sighed Dad. That last was a shock, and I looked at Sweet and wondered if she'd really thought it or if I'd come up with it myself.
How about, Dad suggested, if you let me get back on my feet before you start packing?
Then I realized I'd gone into Dad's room, scared for him, but once inside hadn't even asked how he was or what I could do. Instead, he'd asked, his chest filling with junk, if this is how things were for me in the difficult times. I said, can I get you anything, Dad?
Well, let's see. Yes, a glass of water.
He slapped his pillow into shape and lay back against it.
Say, Reuben, what did you think of Swede's velling? Good, wasn't it?
I haven't eaten.
Mmm.
Shallow breath.
Well, you're gonna like it.
And it's funny, but I did. Sick food or not, I had two bowls. And while I ate them, Swede sat with me and agreed that the high desert was desirable, and that we ought, when Dad got better, to go and at least have a good long look at it. It was the first time I ever persuaded her to my side of anything. Back at the corn crib, I was distressed to realize all my efforts of the morning had brought down only 6 lengths of lath. Elementary math revealed I would be working till Easter unless I got the hang of this. I chose a junction of oak and lath and wedged the bar in. A kid somewhere said,
Hey.
He was in the corn crib, crouched and peeking through laths. I had a slanted view of a boy in a corduroy coat, a fat grinning boy with plugged nostrils. You could see what was plugging them, too. Who are you? I asked.
Raymond?
He said it Raymond, the N getting detained up in nostril country. I'm Rube. Why don't you come out of there?
What you doing?
Ripping this old thing down, I told him. Mr. Layton hired me. Come on out of there. Outside the corn crib, he was more of himself. The coat was unbuttoned and showed layers of shirt. His cheeks were rubbed scabby and looked like sallow Texas grapefruits glazed with effluent. Raymond was much shorter, but I'm guessing he had me by 30 pounds. How old are you, Raymond?
6.
He twisted around and waved at a house across the alley from Mr. Layton's.
That's Grandma's. We live with her, Mom and Nan and me.
He looked at me fearlessly.
Can I watch?
What?
Watch your river down.
Raymond was a good watcher. At first, I didn't want him there because I wasn't adept at the work and feared notice. But Raymond was gifted in not noticing. He sat down in the deep snow and spoke wet, unrelated sentences.
We just moved here last summer. Grandma's house isn't built good. My brother heard a ghost last night. Whee! Like a horse. My dad's muskrat trap got 200 muskrats last year.
A lath sprang free from the crib. I managed to stay on my feet.
I used to get beat up back home. There was a neighborhood kid, Pugger, could mend his thumb all the way back to here.
Poor Raymond. His passages were so obstructed, he had his own dialect. About this time, I discovered a principle of physics. Mr. Layton's crowbar had been broken off and resharpened, and so lacked the slight angle a crowbar needs at the business end. In my ignorance, I worked without fulcrum, a lousy way to pry, until finally a loose lath fell down of its own accord, wedging itself between bar and post. I shoved, and the lath I'd been worrying for 10 minutes squealed loose instantly. Thereafter, I worked with purchase, and things accelerated. Raymond sat in the snow, talking away. I never saw a boy better built for cold. His coat was open wing and wing, but he was radiant with talk, and the wind blew over his big, besmirched cheeks and exposed earlobes with no effect. He was like a small, hot, talkative planet.
How strong are you?
He inquired bluntly. I tore down a lath and flung it on the pile. I'm tearing down a building, aren't I? Boy, it felt good saying that.
You're pretty strong.
Of course, he could have outpulled me in any contest you might name, but at 6, he was too kind to know it. I said, well, I'm older than you.
Hmm?
Yup, I was wrestling a tough one.
Is your brother a murderer?
One of my mitts slipped and the crowbar dropped into the snow. Clawing it out, I regarded Raymond for malice. Where'd you hear that?
Well, he shot those big kids.
Didn't you ever hear of self-defense? He shook his head. I oughtn't have been so sharp. He was only curious.
My dad said he was a murderer.
Then,
my dad's really strong. I bet he could tear that shed down with his bare hands. Could your dad do that?
Sure. Not right now, though. He's got pneumonia.
Oh,
Raymond said.
I had an uncle with pneumonia. He died and had a funeral, but we didn't go.
That corn crib represented the hardest work I'd ever done. Still, I suspect Swede had the tougher job back home. Not the cooking and washing and sweeping, which he'd been doing since we left school, but hearing Dad rack and hawk and bits of his lungs hitting whang in the pan. When I arrived from Layton's those late afternoons, brimming with my own success and breathing deep as I ever had, Swede seemed frighteningly burdened. Of course, with Swede, you got used to periods of deep thought, but this was different, for she was Dad's nurse, and anyone knows a downhearted nurse signifies a sinking patient. This didn't register with me right away. By the time I got home, Dad was usually sleeping quietly, which seemed a good omen, until I crept in one evening, hoping to find him awake. I don't recall what I wanted to tell him, probably how well the corn crib was going, how much money I figured to earn off it, how generally strong and immortal I was feeling now. I stood beside him, wishing he'd awaken, a boy just wanting his dad's attention, and then standing there, I had the dreamlike thought that he'd become me. His breathing something you had to listen hard to hear at all. This was more terrifying than any night I'd spent battling my own lungs. I grabbed Dad's shoulder and brought him awake.
Reuben?
He was startled. His hands came up and took hold of my arms.
Is everything all right?
I was startled right back. You want me to boil some water and soda? Loosen you up? He sat upright and breathed as deeply as he could. Oh, but he was bound tight.
Look, Reuben, I don't think steam's a thing. Maybe you pound my back a little.
So I sat on the edge of his bed, and he braced up best he could, and I whacked him between the shoulder blades. First, as hard as I dared, never having touched my father in this strange way before, and then, as he nodded encouragement and his lungs began to respond, as hard as I could. How I whacked. His back was bony as a fowl's, for the pneumonia had consumed his surplus. He couldn't shore up against even my feeble thumping for more than a minute. But when he sagged back onto his pillow, his breathing was discernibly easier. He smiled.
That corn crib work is helping you, boy.
I finished December 20. A huge day for me. The crib had a roof of sheet tin held tight by 1,000 galvanized nails, and I had to haul the ladder in and hammer upward to loosen it. Deafness threatened. When finally the tin slid away and woofed to earth, I tilted into a snowbank to rest. I wished Raymond would show up. Nothing remained of the crib but its black upright timbers, which for frozen steadfastness seemed a jury of Puritans. I wasted some minutes heaving and grunting, then shoveled to bare earth and sheared them off flush with a cross-cut saw. It took all afternoon. When the last post toppled, I dragged it to the stack by Mr. Layton's garage, missing Raymond's 6-year-old admiration for my modest strength. Had he flattered me then, I'd have swallowed it whole. I stretched the day out long, picking nails and bits of lath from the snow, and finally horsing the noisy sheet of tin up so the whole stack lay recovered by its own roof. Stars were appearing, Venus in the east. I seemed to breathe buckets of air, whole arctics of it. I set the crowbar over my shoulder, thinking of the great Crockett slinging up Betsy at the end of the day. When I got home, Swede was chafed beyond reason. She clattered out the bowls for supper, poured the cornflakes, made Dad's hot water with a spoonful of lemon juice, and slapped it all on a metal tray. Recalling what Dr. Noakes had said regarding her bedside manner, I said, "Are you mad about something, Swede?" She stayed clammed, entered Dad's room to lay supper across his lap, and returned somewhat mellowed with his praiseful thanks. Still, she didn't speak to me. I was certain I'd done something thoughtless, until she finished the dishes and sat down and began to blink. I had a stick of candy in my jacket pocket, a present from Raymond. "Want to split a candy cane?" She nodded, and I broke it in two and gave her the crook. She stuck the long end in her mouth, and in a few minutes pulled it out and pointed it at the hallway door. "Look at 'em all," she said. She was talking about the Christmas cards she taped up, 10 or 12 of them, a bumper crop, because we hadn't much family, one uncle, no aunts, two older cousins, whose wild doings we heard about secondhand. We'd never received more than 6 or 7 Christmas cards a year. This time around, there were new ones, from the de Cuellars, the Stockards, a few others. Don't you like them?
Of course I do.
What's the matter, then? I was thinking how happy she seemed mornings, how excited she always was, pulling on her boots to head up to the post office. Dad would be sitting up with his tea by then, and I'd be going out the door to Mr. Layton's, and Swede would run the few blocks and rifle the P.O. box, a responsibility I envied, particularly now so close to Christmas.
We haven't got nothing from Davy, she said.
It hadn't occurred to me that Davy might send us a Christmas card, him being a fugitive from justice. Was there even precedent for such a thing? Mentally, I ran down a few examples. Cole Younger, Butch Cassidy, John Wesley Hardin. Maybe these fellows were just flush with Christmas spirit, but I'd never heard about it. I mentioned these doubts to my sister.
Wesley was illiterate, Swede said,
casually using the middle name as if on personal terms with the outlaw.
Also, he was a skunk. He wouldn't have sent cards to anybody, and he never got any either.
Well, what about those others?
Cassidy was romantic, you know that.
In fact, I did know it. The romantic quality was something he acquired while vacationing in Bolivia. Swede had read all about the heroic Butch, how he had a fondness for the afternoon siesta, also for the words pardon, señorita, and other poetical phrases. It was easy to believe Cassidy would have sent off his Christmas cards, and on time, too. I was going to ask about Cole Younger, but someone stepped up on the porch and knocked. It was Mr. Layton. He stood out there like a big hunched beetle and wouldn't come in.
Boy, he said, you finished her. Come out here and settle up.
This was the first I'd seen of him since he handed me the crowbar. He'd been sitting at his dime store counter the whole time I tore down his crib. I had wondered how this part of the deal was to happen, and now here he was, bad spine and all.
You done a good job, he said
when I slipped on my boots and stepped out.
Thank you, sir.
Do you know how long that thing has needed wrecking?
No, sir. How long?
He said,
the old man who sold me the place kept horses, Percherons, great big drafters.
I thought of Raymond and the houses across the alley. Where'd he keep them? Isn't the yard sort of small? Mr. Layton chuckled.
It was big then, boy.
I hadn't anything else to ask, and Mr. Layton reached for his billfold. He pulled out 2 $10 bills and a 5 and said,
you done a good job.
Then patted another pocket and came out with 2 chocolate bars, Mr. Good bars. You know that yellow wrapper?
One for you and one for your sister,
he said. And I accepted them and watched him go down the porch steps, needing the railing right the way down. 2 whole days I dreamed with Sweet about the things $25 could buy. The bills were straight voltage, juicing all sorts of hallucinations. Could you buy a Hiawatha bicycle for 25 clams? Sweet thought you could, and moreover figured there was room for her on the handlebars. I was also tempted by the thought of water. I knew a kid, his name is gone, who'd gotten hold of a sweet-natured canoe framed up in cedar and covered with watertight canvas. The boat smelled like a humidor and floated so light the kid claimed to have followed to its source the nameless creek adjoining the bright river. He claimed to have paddled up through brushlands where burnt tamaracks poked from the surface of the creek, and the water slowed to rest, and the quiet was broken by the protruding fins of frantically spawning carp. All this magic from a wooden canoe that had been sitting disused in a barn. The kid, Alfred something, I believe, red-haired and double-jointed, had procured the boat in payment for a few days picking rock in the spring.
I think a canoe, I told Swede.
Telescope, she replied. She'd read some poem about a farmer who so loved the stars that he'd arsoned his place for the insurance money and bought a glass through which the Pleiades became a scatter of diamonds on a velvet cloth. Then again, it was almost Christmas. What about presents? Shamefully, the first person who came to mind was neither Dad nor Swede, but Bethany Orchard, whom I hadn't seen in weeks. What did Bethany want for Christmas? I would have given half the money just to know.
What are you thinking about?
Swede demanded. Such a joyous, greedy talk we'd been having, she didn't want me adrift.
Oh, I don't know,
I faltered badly, though you couldn't have dragged the truth from me. Bethany Orchard. In fact, I had a sudden ache to say her name out loud.
Reuben, you worrying about Davy? Swede asked,
and she looked so motherly and worried that I nodded and put on the gravest face I owned. To my enormous surprise and guilt, she got me in a bear hug and kept me there a while. Poor Swede, she always did think better of me than I had coming. The next day, December 23rd, Dad got out of bed. I woke from dreams of a gravel road along which I walked shoeless, picking up nuggets of gold the size of baby turtles. We had in our bathroom a hot water tap that squeaked persistently when turned, and I heard it plainly as I stooped for nuggets. On and off it squeaked, and then I was awake, and though fiscally disappointed, knew Dad was up and shaving, and that the tapping I heard between squeaks was him knocking his razor against the sink to get the whiskers off. Bounding up, I rapped at the bathroom door and was admitted to the sight of Dad standing at the mirror, soap on half his face and a grin showing where he'd thumbed through lather.
Morning, Reuben.
His voice was quiet, tired, but free of the congestion that had shortened his sentences of late.
Are you well?
I couldn't believe it. Just last night I had heard him coughing.
Reuben, you look starved. Go off and start some oatmeal, why don't you?
So off I went rejoicing, banging around the kitchen until Swede awoke and came in to issue instructions. Stirring the pot, she told me it was a big day and to get the maple syrup out of the back cupboard. I looked. The syrup was gone.
Brown sugar, then, she said, above the toaster.
I shook my head. We used it up.
White sugar.
But that bowl, too, was nearly empty. And when I got out the 10-pound canister in which we kept reserves, the scoop inside rattled sorrowfully. Swede was disgusted.
Well, get out some apples.
We had a bag of old apples in the refrigerator, long ignored on account of their soft flesh and wrinkly complexions. But I peeled them down and chopped them small, and Swede found some Karo syrup and poured it in the oatmeal and told me to round up Dad. He had finished shaving and was in his bedroom. I knocked and, getting no response, went in. As I did, he stepped from the closet where he'd been rummaging, and I glimpsed him upright and as he truly was. A scream formed in my gut and emerged as a whimper. When shaving, he'd worn a big T-shirt that fell below the waist of his pants, disguising his exsicated frame just as the lather disguised his face, so obscured he might have been a healthy man, if thin. Now he came out of the closet, bare-faced and bare-chested. His torso was not his, but someone else's, a drawn maroons from some sea story. His face, too, was bereft of all extra, so that suddenly I barely recognized him. How had this escaped me? Even his eyes had the transparency of incarceration, and he looked at me out of them with a mercy and pain that confused me beyond what small troubles I'd ever thought to know. He nodded slightly, I suppose wondering what to say.
You and Swede get that oatmeal ready?
Yes, sir. I couldn't stop looking at him, at the way his khakis were belted across his hip bones. He said,
I'm a little surprised myself, you know.
In retrospect, it's hard to believe I didn't see instantly what to do with that money. But when it's the first you've earned by sweat, you see it as special, and by golly, not to be spent on less than the desire of your grasping heart. The more I thought about old Alfred and his cedar canoe, the more I saw myself paddling one just like it, convinced similar exquisite vessels lay concealed in dairy barns all over the county. I told Swede of my decision.
We're out of food, Reuben, she answered.
Having used great gestures describing the canoe I planned to purchase and the adventures we would enjoy thereafter, it irritated me that she would change the subject.
Well, let's go get some, then. We can't.
I really did need it spelled out for me. The truth is, I'd been wondering when Swede would take the initiative and suggest we go up to the Red Owl for groceries. We often did the shopping, the two of us, pulling our painted wagon, Dad's money in my pocket. In the winter, we used a toboggan.
If we spend any more money right now, she said, we shall be broke.
Her emphasis on shall put me in mind, as it was certainly meant to, of Pastor Reach, whose inflections left you in no doubt of his good sense. I was smitten into silence while Swede stacked dishes in the sink and ran water on them and waited for me to make myself gallant. But I was more interested in canoes than gallantry. I was annoyed that we were out of money, and Christmas almost here. Also that Swede knew we were out of money before I did, and her younger than me. I was annoyed that I'd worked hard to earn $25 and now would have to give my $25 to Otto Schock, the Red Owl man. There was a lot to be annoyed about, and I could afford to grouse because Dad had eaten his small breakfast and thanked us and gone back straight away to his bed of exhaustion. I stood festering in the kitchen. "You don't want a canoe, then?" I like to believe that we have all said things that approach this in stupidity. Swede didn't answer, but swabbed the dishes and rinsed them and laid them up to dry. Normally, I'd have taken a towel and wiped them myself, but it's difficult to do productive work and fume simultaneously. The labor dissipates your righteous steam. So I stood, glaring at the back of her little blonde head, which was tilted in thoughtful mien. Sensing she was going to say something sagacious, I started to leave the kitchen, but was too late. "In Little Women," she said, "see, when Joe cut off her hair and sold it to pay for Marmee's train fare, you remember?" Well, of course I remembered. After the shearing, Joe had gone home and stunned them all with her sacrificial present, the profit from her bounteous hair, her one beauty, as her sister so backhandedly put it. "If Marmee had begged Joe to go cut off her hair and sell it," Swede hypothesized, "I wonder how heroic a thing it would have been." I didn't say anything, but I thought, "Aw, crumb." Here are some of the things we bought, Swede and I, having propped Dad in bed with a cup of beef tea. Aunt Jemima syrup in a brown bottle, 20 pounds of white Robin Hood flour, a sack of raisins and another of currants, 2 gallons of whole milk, a 3-pound can of Hills Brothers coffee, a box of chocolates, free Otto Schock swore of clandestine jellies, and a Christmas turkey purchased live from the poultryman on the edge of town, who had me hold the bird's legs as he beheaded it. How they flailed and pounded in my palms. That creature just flung me all over the yard. Strangely, it was the coffee Dad seemed most happy to see, and which, brewed, caused our home to feel again like a place where we might live right side up. Dad hummed, "God rest you, merry gentlemen." As he measured grounds into the basket and lit the gas, the pot ticked as it heated, and as it perked, a smell came forth like the sunlit hillsides of Mexico, a smell like morning camps described by Theodore Roosevelt in his days as a rancher in North Dakota. Then Dad sat at the kitchen table with a white ceramic cup all asteam and his King James before him, and, seeing me, reached out to seize me at the muscle. "That's a hero's arm," he declared. "Thank you, Rube, for stepping in. I'll get strong now. Look here." And he shadowboxed a moment where he sat, his hands quick again like Davy's. "I know it," I said, for his eyes were clear and his voice had unmuddied and found its register again. Then somebody knocked, and when I poked my head out the kitchen, Swede was admitting a man in a gray pinstripe suit. His hair was brown and flattened round his temples, as if he'd just removed a fedora. He had a slick ID card in his hand, and he was sniffing our newly rejuvenated air.
"Is that coffee fresh?" he asked.
It has been a defining trait of our family. The moment some simple but meaningful treat is prepared, a good fish soup or the first pot of coffee in weeks, up trots some uninvited person with an appetite. The man in the suit was named Andreessen. He was a federal investigator and had the boldness to state that he expected to nab Davy before the turn of the year. He used that word, nab, and I thought Swede might kick him or perhaps lurch suddenly with the coffee, for she was serving him a cup. I hoped she would. He was smug, clearly an enemy. But she set the coffee primly before him, and Andreessen picked it up and sipped it without acknowledging the hospitality, and said to Dad, "He's just a kid still, after all. Going to get pretty lonesome this time of year. He's going to make contact with you, Mr. Land.
You want to do the right thing when he does.
Which is? Dad didn't care much for Andreessen either. Andreessen could tell it and eased his tone a little. I know you don't want your son hurt. So when he calls you or writes to you or however he does it, just do what's best for him. Andreessen slipped a card from the vest pocket of his suit. You can reach me here.
I didn't know you fellows were interested, Dad said. It wasn't impertinence, it was the truth. Until now, we'd had speech with the local cops, county cops, and state cops. Andreessen was our first Fed. Naturally, I disliked him from the start.
Oh, we suspect he's crossed state lines. That makes him our job.
Dad stood and remained standing until Andreessen had to also. Dad said, Well, thanks for coming by.
When he gets in touch, Mr. Land, you've got my number.
Dad smiled at the floor a moment, so thin you could see his strength was not his own, then looked up and replied, Mr. Andreessen, you and I will not speak again. That night, Swede told me the story of how Cole Younger was brought in after the bank raid in Northfield. Cole and his brother James and a couple others. 20 bullet holes they had between the three of them, 11 in Cole alone. They weren't his first, either. Why, he had 7 or 8 others healed and aching from previous encounters. What sort of specimen do you need to be to survive carnage on that order? But in they came at last, the bloodied Youngers, and Swede told me how they were paraded in chains through the streets, and how the citizens gathered in grief and outrage to watch them pass, flinging stones and horse manure. For the Youngers, as I well knew, had come to town with the James boys, Frank and Jesse, and in result, a handsome, shy, and newly married bank teller named Haywood lay cold and suited in the parlor of his mother's house. This was the question on the minds of the righteous. Which of these haggard devils had done for Mr. Haywood? The question was directed most pointedly to Cole, who'd been in the bank when the shots were fired.
Night before Cole went on trial, she said, the Sheriff Paxton went in his cell. He gave Cole paper and ink, saying, Sir, if you will name Haywood's killer, I will personally solicit for your freedom.
Swede was quiet in the dark bedroom, and I imagined the tired and oft-perforated outlaw lying in his cell, knowing a word could condemn the guilty man and buy himself liberty at the same time. Putting myself in like position, saying it were I, who'd been shot 11 times, and, for example, old Raymond, who'd put the lead to Haywood, I'd have broken 3 ink pens in my rush to impart the truth. Of course, Raymond was only 6, but big enough to have done the job. And what did Mr. Younger do?
In the morning, Swede said with great portent, Paxton came for his answer. It was early, just sunrise.
She let this sink a moment so I could see what she was seeing. The sheriff standing at the cell door, his head bowed slightly, a fist at his lips. There'd be a pale pink bar-striped window. There'd be the dawn-lit form of Cole rising to cross the cell. Yes, and I could even hear it happening. The sheriff clearing his throat, the chipping of some bird at the outset of day, the groan of the bunk as Cole heaved himself off and moved to the door with the folded paper.
He handed it through the bars and turned his back, Swede whispered. Paxton looked at the paper and it said, Be true to your friends, though the heavens fall.
Dazzled, I told her it was the best thing a mortal ever did. Immediately my conscience yelped. After all, a person has to remember Colonel Travis and his line in the dirt at the Alamo. A person can't forget the pirate Lafitte, saving New Orleans in the War of 1812, when fighting for the British would have made him rich. Without such acts, what good is history? But I mentioned none of this to Swede. She'd work awfully hard to set that scene. What did it hurt me to be generous? The good thing about our reduced circumstances going into Christmas was that our expectations changed. They lowered themselves to a worthy place. After walking in on my gaunt father, I didn't think about Spartacus anymore. After the money was spent, I was glad it had bought coffee and flour instead of any canoe. Of course, we missed the suspense associated with lumpy stockings. We missed the call of the parcels. We missed the Christmas spruce. Swede especially wanted a tree, and at the last minute hung a few pathetic bulbs outside in one visible from our kitchen window. It was an old hackberry stunted from bad soil. Even grass had a hard time in roofing. but a hackberry's tough and knobbly as an old man. Swede rose early and, gritting her teeth against the world, set about preparing more Christmas dinner than we could ever consume. We got that turkey, I mentioned, him of the will to live. He went more than 15 pounds. We had a heavy glass bowl of cranberries Dr. Noakes had brought over, along with a pie from Mrs. Noakes called a Bob Andy pie, a creamy thing I've looked for since without success. We had sweet potatoes, though Swede in her exuberance went a little large with the brown sugar. All these things she went ahead with on Christmas Eve day because she simply could not wait for the 25th. "I need Christmas now," she said, her hands cupped with breadcrumbs disappearing into the bird. And so during the day, our appetites rose. Food appeared raw on counters and was pounded and rubbed, seasoned and put to cook. Our expectations were caught and surmounted by smells, an encyclopedic warmth of poultry, potato, oven fruit, honey, yeast, coffee. Dad slept the morning through and in the afternoon woke agitated under the weight of smells. When he walked past me, I heard his stomach growl. No, it snorted, like a buck in rut, the healthiest sound he'd produced in weeks. All that long afternoon, we stalked the house while Swede fussed, and the smells rose up, and the sun sank down. And finally, when the plates were arranged, and the cider poured, and Swede lit a candle and pronounced a call for Christmas dinner, two things happened. Dad laughed aloud for pure delight, and someone climbed up on our porch and knocked. Did you see that coming? You ought to, I would say. By now, you ought to. And yet so humble were our expectations for this Christmas. So glad were we to simply have our dad upright and able to laugh and his stomach to growl. Not even uninvited guests could quench us. And Dad himself went to the door, and when he opened it, in stepped our good friend Mr. De Cuellar with his resplendent wife, whose hair was done up in red and silver ribbons. And in they came, shouting, "Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas!" And to me, they handed a long box, which turned out to hold a reflecting telescope of astonishing power. And to Swede, they gave a pair of boots and a lariat with a ring of polished steel. And into Dad's hand, they pressed a key and told him to look out at the street. 4 weeks ago, the traveling salesman, Tin Lurvy, had taken ill in a hotel room in Idaho. He had driven himself to a hospital in the wee hours, and though he parked safely, his poor heart burst before he turned off the ignition, so that he sat there behind the wheel until dawn, his engine idling smoothly. And in his will, Tin Lurvy left his house to an uncle and his car to a nephew, and to Jeremiah Land he had left his brand-new 1963 Airstream trailer, a 20-footer with a kitchen and every necessary thing, a luxurious purchase Tin had saved toward for years. And the reason we didn't know this earlier was that our telephone service had been cut off. I'd wondered once or twice why nobody called. I don't have the gift to aptly describe the rest of that evening, except to say it was a Christmas Eve beyond all gasping wishes, and that even the absence of Davy seemed somehow more temporal and bearable because of the De Cuellar's appearance and Tin Lurvy's marvelous benediction. In fact, we moved our whole dinner out to the Airstream, which Tin himself had never used. We lit the stove for heat and carried out the candle and the turkey and everything. And later, when the conversation was low and I had set up the telescope and was taking turns with Dad and Mr. De Cuellar looking at the moon, I asked Dad why he kept laughing. What a sound that was. His laugh, low and confident again, like your best friend's laugh in the darkness when you believed he was gone forever. And Dad said, "Because I was praying this morning, and I prayed, 'Lord, send Davy home to us, or if not, Lord, do this, send us to Davy.'" The substance of things hoped for. Remember August Schultz, in whose barley I made the most panicked job a boy ever did of shooting a wild goose? At the bottom of a January cold snap, we received a 3-cent postcard from August. "Hello, all. Old friend Speedy came by last night. I wondered if he would, and by goodness he did. Weasley skinny but strong. Sends regards. We were glad to have him. Birdie had kielbasa. it went fast. Og and Bertie. P.S. Best to your friend Andreessen. Do you think that put Dad in excellent humor? Swede came from the post office in high color, flag-waving that card, which confirmed what she'd been feeling for weeks. That Davy was all right. That he was gone west in the persistent fashion of outlaws. That he remained the big brother who loved us all, Christmas card or no. Wickedly satisfying to Swede was August's postscript. The hated Fed must have made himself apparent to our friends in North Dakota, the louse. Well, Swede was ready right then to step into the airstream and ride to the western sun. Dad himself was close to ready. The day after Christmas, he'd begun preparing to leave. Understand, this was done on faith alone. Keep in mind, we hadn't yet heard from August Schultz. Keep in mind, we had no word at all. No hint of eye, nor ear, nor tingling spine as to where our boy was aimed. And yet Dad began to stock up. Cash was a difficulty, so he commenced to lay hold of unattached items around the house and sell them, doing so with an impish glee. His bedroom mirror went first, a useless piece of furniture given who owned it, and it brought $3, which turned into 15 cans of pork and beans from the Red Owl. The beans went into the deep, mesmerizing pantry of the airstream, a monstrous and comforting hole. You could stack food in there all morning. Dad next sold 2 pine dressers for $5 each. He bought a case of Dinty Moore, 2 canned hams, some hash. He sold a creeper long used to get under the Plymouth and change the oil. $1, 8 cans of chicken noodle. Each day, familiar things went away from us. Each day, Dad, normally lackadaisical about commerce, tallied up the take and what food it might procure. Faith brought this about. Faith, as Dad saw it, had delivered unto us the Airstream trailer, and Faith would direct our travels. "Where do you think you're going?" Dr. Noakes demanded. I think he feared the sickness had touched the part of Dad's brain in charge of good sense. "What do you have for directions?" he asked. And Dad, eyebrows raised in delight with his forthcoming answer, said, "I have the substance of things hoped for. I have the anticipation of things unseen." Dr. Noakes told him point blank he was out of his mind. Dad laughed aloud. 10 minutes later, with the doctor looking on, he sold his own bed, minus the putrescent mattress, to a couple who appeared stuttering on our porch. They'd just bought their first home, a neat shack, red paint faded to a newlywed's blush. Impoverished by this bold purchase, they'd slept on the floor until the young man, killing salamanders with a spade in the dirt basement, found a mildewed linen bag strung up in the joists. The bag contained 7 Liberty dollars. They loaded Dad's bed on a creaking trailer and drove off, waving as if we were fond relatives. Dr. Noakes walked away in disgust. Chuckling, Dad spread the silver dollars before us to admire. He wrote a list and told us to pull the toboggan up to Otto Schock's. Noodles, tuna, bouillon, dry milk, salt, crackers, hard storage apples, chocolate bars. We elbowed and noogied all the way to the store. We were swept up, I tell you. Infected with something, events seemed a wide water into which we'd stepped only to be yanked downstream toward some joyful end. We piled food into the trailer while Dad did the things necessary to go away for who knew how long. He drained pipes, rope-caulked windows, and otherwise buttoned down the house. While we watched from inside, he dragged his mattress to a backyard snowbank and soaked it with kerosene and stood back in his canvas parka and threw on a match. It was well past dark, and the flames poured up, showing the whole orange snowbound yard, the paintless garage, the fingery, misshapen hackberry tree, the black, straight-up shape of Dad. How could we not believe the Lord would guide us? How could we not have faith? For the foundation had been laid in prayer and sorrow. Since that fearful night, Dad had responded with the almost impossible work of belief. He had burned with repentance, as though his own hand had fired the gun. He had laid up prayer as if with a trowel. You know this is true, and if you don't, it is I, the witness, who am to blame. We pulled out after a frostbit sunrise, the 22nd of January. I remember how the front end of the Plymouth heaved upward, surprised at its rearward weight. I remember how poor and strange the house looked among its neighbors as we eased away, chimney a heap of dead bricks, windows glazed with ice and dirt. Already it seemed close in spirit to those weedy barns you see all gray and forgotten and sadly available to anyone who will pay the taxes. And cold, my goodness. For 2 weeks we'd been gripped by a cold snap which on the average night reached 30 below. Very dismaying to Sweet and me, since we intended to ride in the plenteousness of the airstream. How we'd planned to sprawl and stretch and scramble around. Yes, the trailer had a gas heater, but Dad couldn't be persuaded to travel lit. Of course, the Plymouth's own heater was a foreseeable disaster. We probably weren't much warmer in our own backseat army blankets than we would have been in the trailer, or outside, for that matter, in the blistering wind. On the way out, we idled at the post office so Dad could stop the mail. Sweet and I stayed in the car. She was already in a book. I remember roofing looked different that morning. Smaller. Dearer. Seized by romance, I wish Bethany Orchard would walk right by then and see us, hitched to the airstream, on the very sill of a long and perilous adventure, the outcome of which remained in doubt. Oh yes, here she'd come. Bethany, sent for the mail by her cheerless father, a vulnerable elfin figure wrapped against the wind. Seeing my determined profile in the window, she'd fly to me.
You're leaving?
And she'd look away, that I might not see the water standing in her eyes. I'd have gotten a goodbye kiss eventually. I could see it coming. Except then a figure appeared coming up the walk. Not Bethany, but an old man in a ruinous corduroy barn coat. A listing, bareheaded old man, undone and tattered, untrustful of his feet. Swede, look at that guy. He came on, fighting the wind. His hair was raked up and oily. His eyes were shut. His lips were moving. I think he's praying, I told her. The old man's hands looked like suet, hanging there out of his sleeves. Maybe for balance, Swede said. Sort of a cruel remark, wouldn't you say? I glanced at her. She was watching the old bum's rough go, staying upright, skinny shoulders atilt, one hand swaying forward now, bumping the post office door. It's old Mr. Finch, she pointed out. He was much more sorrowful to look at than he had been at Davy's trial. Could he even have this day's life left in him? He's freezing, I said. Swede was back in her book, but I was held tight by the old man's attempts to grip the handle, then to open that big glass door against the wind, his eyes still shut, mind you, and his mouth slack open. He looked dead, is what I'm telling you. Like a man so trampled of spirit, he'd given over the strength of limbs. I watched his face in his futile, suety hands, and for the first time a question nipped at me. Was it possible that real loss had occurred at the death of Israel Finch? That real grief had been felt? Of course, you could say old Mr. Finch was a helpless and habitual drunk, and whatever was lost in him was lost long ago. You could say so. I'm not suggesting you wouldn't have a strong case. From roofing, it is some 80 miles to North Dakota. We drove without talking for a good while. After weeks of anticipation, I'll confess to feeling let down. It was so cold my limbs seemed heavy and far away. Dad drank coffee, looking at the frozen farmsteads we passed, clumped at the end of their long driveways. The Plymouth itself moaned as we drove, sounding perhaps not up to this long and heavy haul. We crossed the border late in the morning, and Swede sat up, blowing on her fingers, and asked what that thing in the road was. "Can't tell," Dad said. "It's moving." It was a black shape in the road, far ahead, that seemed to grow and shrink. So small a thing we mightn't have noticed elsewhere, but on the broad white flats of Dakota the eye goes to such specks. "Crow?" Dad said. "It's moving wrong," Swede replied. We drove on. The black object rose and dropped and assumed guessable size, about like a turtle. "Aw, it's a piece of old trash," Swede said. as if some hopes had been fastened to it. But getting closer, we saw it was a crow, after all, and dead. Struck by a car, it lay all mashed to the road, but for one free wing, which rose and fell by the gusts. It was a much more grievous sight than you'd think, a dead crow lying in the road out in the heart of no place, and just before we reached it, the wind brought up that wing again, so it looked like a thing asking mercy. We drove on a mile or so. "I was just thinking," Dad said. "All the years I spent in North Dakota, that's the first crow I ever saw hit on the road." We hadn't anything to say to that. "They're awfully smart birds," Dad mused. "They get out of the way." "What's that?" Swede pointed to something else black, farther on. This time, no one conjectured. We drove on, and it was another crow, cruelly pasted and lying over at the edge, the second Dad had seen in all his years. "Well, imagine that," he said. We reached August's late afternoon. Having retreated to sleep, I snapped from a dream in which Swede's persistent badman, Valdez, had got into the airstream and crawled into my bunk. I knew he was there, but couldn't tell anyone. Not that I didn't want to, I just couldn't say the right words. Time after time, I got Dad's attention, only to mumble some nursery rhyme instead of the evil fact. Meantime, Valdez snored away in my bunk. He sounded like an Alice Chalmers, and no one could hear him but me. "Wake up, Rube," Dad said, as we bounced into August's yard. Relieved, I was still nonetheless unbalanced by the dream and stumbled up to the house with it still attached. Unbundling us in her hot kitchen, Bertie teased kindly, "Somebody's too sleepy to say hello." But that was only part of it. In truth, I was a little scared and preoccupied about where we'd go from here. For I had asked this of Dad the previous night, asked it straight out. "Where do we go from August's?" He didn't know. "We'd simply go forth," he said, "like the children of Israel when they packed up and cameled out of Egypt." He meant to encourage me. Just like us, the Israelites hadn't any idea where they'd end up. Just like us, they were traveling by faith. Indeed, it did impart a thrill. Yet the trip thus far in the frigid and torpid Plymouth had reminded me what a hard time the chosen people actually had of it. Once traveling, it's remarkable how quickly faith erodes. It starts to look like something else. Ignorance, for example. Same thing happened to the Israelites. Sure, it's weak, but sometimes you'd rather just have a map. The last thing he would do. Of course, fear and doubt must flee when such gentle hosts as August and Bertie take charge of you, and in fact a supper of creamed chicken and beans and sliced nut bread can go a long way toward the devil's discredit. Yet, for all the Schultz's home-cooked beneficence, their most nourishing offerings were details. "He walked into the yard just before midnight," August said, leaning toward Swede, whom he'd placed on his right hand. "Ricky," their walker hound, "barking his dumb head off. All of a sudden he stops, just his stumpy tail beating against the house. I turn on the porch light, and there's Davy sitting on the steps and that dog shivering all over him." Oh, we were starved for details. After all, there'd been but the barest crumb since Davy's escape. We'd no inkling of how he'd traveled, not counting a day or two on Nelson Svedvig's mare. No whisper of where he might have stayed, nothing from which we might draw strength. Without a detail or two, even an imagination as mighty as Swede's begins to atrophy. Memory calcifies. One day you wake up, and your brother is a legend, even to you. "Tell how he looked," Dad said.
"Why, same as always, I guess," August said. "Just more grown up. He had a clean cut, right here, under his ear."
A shaving cut, it turned out. Having hitched as far as Raddock, Davy'd walked into a drugstore and bought soap and a razor, employing them in the restroom of a Shell station close by. Then, collaring up, he stepped north into a quartering wind, meeting, as he told August, not one car on 12 miles of blacktop.
"He was dressed warm?" Dad asked.
"Why, I guess so," August said. At which Bertie rolled her eyes and made amendment.
"He was underdressed," she said, "wearing an old barn coat. I sewed on some buttons, holed pants, no hat,
cotton gloves, and Jeremiah, he was awfully thin.
Then he assuredly came to the right place, Dad replied, real comfort in his voice for the first time in many days, for it was good to imagine Davy appearing on the doorstep of those who loved him. No doubt Bertie had inventoried Davy's scarcities even as she stood at the stove reheating kielbasa. He had a glaze of dirt around his neck, she would tell Dad later, but was pink and clean on his face and ears. He ate, Bertie said, like a polite but famished baby hawk. Said thank you, please, but barely chewed.
Does he miss us? Sweet asked. Did he say he missed us?
Well, now, August said.
Like sunshine, Bertie put in. He said it's like having no sun in the sky, Sweet. He misses you that much.
I remember thinking that was a funny thing for Davy to say, him not being generally lyrical. Yet Bertie looked so sternly at August, I knew she must be remembering correctly. Swede teared up and put a hand over her mouth.
August, Bertie suggested after a beat, tell about the fella who gave Davy the ride.
What a tasty particular. Thumbing west, Davy'd been picked up by a man in an Oldsmobile full of musical instruments. They lay uncased in the back seat, a button accordion, saxophone, tin whistle rolling around in the back window, and more than one trumpet haphazardly swaddled in what appeared to be tattered suit coats. The driver told Davy he was from Wisconsin, heading for Los Angeles, where he would certainly get on television. He said there were actually three trumpets, and they were linked together by a machined brace of his own design. By holding them just so, he was able to play all three at once. The man's face was grained as an old board, and he had a dark pompadour ideally groomed, even at this hour. He asked Davy for money and offered to stop right there on the highway and play the Bugler's Holiday. If the TV producers in Los Angeles didn't like trumpets, he also had, in the trunk, an amplifier and a brand new Dan Electro guitar on which he could play recognizable pieces of Mozart.
Show people, August said in wonder.
One more gratifying detail?
Sure.
Davy, retiring upstairs, had twice laughed in his sleep. A strange thing to hear, said Bertie, who lay wakeful all that night, a boyish laugh drifting down those stairs again. I can't describe the sort of peace this conversation gave me. Davy was practically in the room with us. Every creak of the old house was like his footstep. I believe it was one of those rare nights Dad would have let us stay up late. But August said, you kids take the west room tonight. And that was it for us. Bedtime. Never mind, we'd both slept on the way. I looked an appeal at Dad, but got no help. Being both guests and children, Swede and I were entirely at the whim of our hosts, who meant nothing but well.
Okay,
Swede said, very pliably, it seemed to me. Why, we'd barely got started.
I'm tired, Reuben, she insisted, seeing my look.
Then I understood and showed it by giving out a nice overdone stretch and a yawn. Bertie said,
oh, you sweeties,
August nodding along indulgently. Only Dad was not taken in. He looked me in the eye. All worn out, huh? I couldn't just look at him and lie, so I shrugged, assuming the guilty appearance of the habitual eavesdropper. What Swede had remembered, and Dad knew it, was a swell architectural feature of that upstairs bedroom, a ventilation grate, about a foot square set into the floor. A curious visitor tucked up in that room could slide from bed and hear every syllable spoken in the kitchen below. Of course, there was the chance the adults might decide to talk off in the parlor, which had soft chairs and a davenport and a huge round-shouldered Zenith radio against the wall. Also, Bertie's collection of tiny spoons from all 50 states, also a set of Japanese swords August had procured while stationed in the Pacific. But the coffee pot was in the kitchen, and the action pretty much stayed there. Swede said no conversation in any room but the kitchen was worth overhearing anyway, something I'd guess is still true in much of North Dakota. Boy, that west room was cold, though. Minutes after Dad tucked us in and listened to us pray and left us under 50 or so quilts, Swede said,
can you hear what they're saying from here?
No. We eyed the grate some 8 feet away. Light came up from it, and soft voices and coffee smell. Heat was theoretically rising also. It was hard to tell.
We could shove the bed over there, I suggested. They'd hear. Laughter came up through the grate. Adults always start in with that as soon as the kids are in bed. Let's just tough it out, Swede said. Hawkeye and Uncas wouldn't even feel this cold. Huckleberry Finn wouldn't even notice it. Come on. But I already had the covers tucked hood-like around the top of my head. A wind had risen outside and was mourning in the eaves. The curtains were ghosting out from the wall. That's how leaky those old windows were. Don't tell me you want to go to sleep, Swede said, between her teeth. We'll freeze solid, I told her. August will come up tomorrow, and we'll be down on the floor dead. We'll be all purple. More laughter from below, quickly subsiding to a more serious tone. Swede said, I'm going, and slid out and crouched at the grate. I can see her still, arm-wrapped knees, face resolute, lit from below. I thought I heard Davy's name. What is it? I whispered. What'd they say? She waved at me to shush. You know what? I could see her breath. Finally, I hopped out of bed and yanked off the two topmost quilts and heaved them over Swede like a tent and crawled in with her. She grabbed my hand. Hers was so cold it felt papery. No notion at all, August was saying, down in the kitchen. It was hard to know how to talk. I'm sure it was, Dad replied. I'm grateful to you for helping him. Bertie said, Jeremiah, he doesn't know the trouble he's in. He didn't know who Andreessen was. What did you tell him? August said, We talked to him the best we could. He seemed careless about it, said he hadn't read the papers or heard the radio. There was a long silence in which Bertie got up and poured coffee, and Swede leaned up to my ear and whispered, Ratfink, in reference to the Fed Andreessen, a word I hadn't heard before. It almost gave me the giggles. Ratfink. It's vulgar, I know it. One of those terms that makes it worthwhile having enemies. Jeremiah, August said. Was it like the newspaper said? The way Davy shot those boys? Dad said, Yes, pretty much as it said. He shot them down. Yes. At these words, a thing happened I can't explain. Think of some small furry animal, say a vole, going right up your spine with its cold little claws. It shook me. Swede put both arms around me or I'd have gone back to bed. Just so, August said, after waiting a moment. He wanted the story, of course, and why not? Being an old friend of the family doesn't exempt you from curiosity. Though Bertie must have thought his mild pry undignified, because she said, August? Just that, just his name. He shouldn't have, Dad said. It's true, he shouldn't have. That jury would have had to convict him. You didn't see it happen, though, August said. No, Reuben saw it. I'd trade with him if I could. I didn't understand this right away. Trade what? Poor boy. This from Bertie, speaking of Davy, I figured, out in the weather with his collar turned up. But she meant me, for Dad said, You'd be surprised, Bertie. He's been real grown up. He and Swede both, they've stood up better than I have, he added. It was hard talk to decipher. What was supposed to happen to you if you were present at a tragedy? Was there some sort of damage? I wasn't sure. The fact is, beyond the occasional scary dream, my chief response to the shooting was a self-centered misery that David had to go away. I just missed my brother. They talked a while longer, in fact a long while, but most of it went by me. Swede could crouch forever, but my knees weren't made for it. I started thinking about catchers, Earl Batty and so forth, guys who squatted that way 9 innings a day. Also the cold was creeping in under those blankets, and when I tuned my ears back to the adults, they were talking about wheat. The one detail I missed, which Swede told me about the next day, was that Davy had a toothache. He had eaten his kielbasa all right, but was careful about drinking the cold milk Bertie poured him. It pained a molar right down to the root. Bertie had suggested he stay long enough to see a dentist, an idea he politely turned aside. Then Bertie, her heart emboldened, pressed him to give up outlawry and return home and offer himself up for justice. In such public repentance, she said, lay his best chance for what might yet become a fruitful life. And this, we'd said, brought a great smile to Davy's face, and in that smile the Schultzes saw the truth, that turning himself in would be the very last thing Davy would do in his life, however long it lasted. After relating this, we'd said, Bertie had sounded upset and gone to bed, so I suppose wheat came up soon thereafter. I woke the next morning smelling change. No metaphors here. Something was different to my actual nose. The air felt heavy, the quilts too, as blankets feel on camp-out mornings. Rising, I dress by a closet light, shutting the door mostly to keep the brightness off Swede, who was a tough one to sneak out on, not to mention unforgiving afterward. I've always liked the feeling of being the first one awake in the morning. It makes you daring somehow. I went down to the kitchen and poked around carefully. Didn't turn on any lights for fear of rousting August or Dad. Lifting the coffee pot off the stove, I found it half full. There were matches on the wall, and I smooched one. To use a word, Sweet herself smooched off Mr. Twain, scratched it, and lit the gas. It made a lovely blue light in the dark kitchen. In no time, the pot was ticking away, and I felt self-sufficient and borderline sneaky. Then August scuffed into the kitchen in his nightshirt. He had an electric candle in his hand, one of those which comes on by itself when you pick it up in the night. "Feel better this morning, Rube? You cough some in your sleep."
"Yes, sir. I didn't mean to wake you."
"Making coffee?"
"Just heating it. Is that all right?"
He opened a cupboard and reached down a box of sugar lumps. I opened another and set out two cups. "Saucers," August said. "I got them also." He moved to the table, a strangely discordant sight in that nightshirt of his. He walked always at a slight tilt. He had poor balance, particularly in the dark, since being struck on the ear by a draft horse he'd been shoeing years before. The horse, Mike, hadn't meant harm, but had swung his head round at the very moment August dropped a hoof and stood up. Mike was a Percheron of heroic dimension. His head probably weighed 120 pounds. August recovered quickly. He was no weakling himself, but it is a fact that he tipped over easily thereafter. He said, "You smell that this morning?" He meant the change I mentioned earlier. "I don't know what it is," I admitted. What it smelled like to me was a shovelful of earth, a wet day in spring. "It's fog," August said. He put out the electric candle, and we sat there in the dark, smelling the air. August was right. I recognized the smell once he'd identified it. "It's a thing about fog," he continued. "Doesn't matter when it comes, it smells like April. Bertie was born April 22nd, he confided. "Every time it fogs like this, I tell her, 'Happy birthday, love.'" On receipt of this intimate remark, I suddenly understood what had been given me. Never before had I been with Dad's best and oldest friend, the beloved August Schultz, without Dad present. Nor had I been old enough to appreciate